Can I say good evening, everybody? My name's Anthony Giddens, Director of the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this evening, and particularly, of course, to welcome our very distinguished guest, Dr. Rolf Breuer. Dr. Breuer is a lawyer by training originally, but he spent his whole career at Deutsche Bank, where he is now spokesman of the Board of Managing Directors. Deutsche Bank, I'm happy to say, is a leading sponsor of the Centre for the Analysis of Risk and Regulation here at the LSE, and the Centre is actually hosting this visit tonight. What we're trying to do at the LSE around the theme of risk, I hope this audience will agree, is really, really interesting. What we're trying to do is to get together the various fields of the analysis of risk that have been largely separate in the past. You have a lot of discussion of financial risk, a lot of discussion of ecological risk, a lot of discussion of welfare and health risk, and great debates about operational risk that companies face. No one has ever brought these things together in a single policy-driven enterprise before, and we're very happy that Deutsche Bank is actively joining us in this enterprise, which we hope will make a big impact on business and government, as well as be an intellectual cutting-edge program. Deutsche Bank, of course, is the largest bank in Germany. It's been highly influential in the country, especially in the post-war reconstruction period, and directly contributed to the famous economic miracle. Deutsche Bank has traditionally held shares in a large number of German industrial companies in the consensus-driven German social market economy. This differs, of course, from the Anglo-Saxon American banking model, where banks traditionally have been operating at a distance from industrial companies. Recently, Deutsche Bank has invested significantly in the new information economy, opening online banking ventures, striking an alliance with SAP, a big German software house, to offer financial services through virtual exchanges, and has established an internet retail venture. In the last week, as I'm sure everyone in the audience will be only too conscious of, Deutsche Bank has announced its intention to merge with Dresdner Bank and to run its joint retail banking network in cooperation with Allianz, another major player in the German economy. Deutsche Bank, Dresdner Bank, and Allianz all plan, as I understand it, to sell off their cross holdings in one another, plus also their stakes in other German businesses. This development is partly influenced by the recent decision of the German government to lift the taxation requirements from the disposal of corporate shareholdings, allowing the large German companies to unravel their cross-shareholding. I think it would be difficult to underestimate the significance of this development. Rolf Breuer has recently stated, famously already, I think, that this marks the end of Germany PLC, opening up the German economy to international competition and transparency. A really good article about this just appeared in the New York Times, and I was just going to read you a quotation from that article, where it says, in the last few months, the structure and ethos underlying fortress Germany have begun to crack like a house on a California fault line. Well, the consequences of this are problematic and difficult, and as well as very promising. And I presume that Dr. Breuer will at least touch on some of these in his lecture tonight. Again, I'm very, very happy to welcome him here to his first visit to the LSE. The title of his lecture tonight is Banking in the 21st Century, Strategies and Challenges. Please welcome him here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is both an honor and a great pleasure to have the opportunity to talk to you about a topic which, of course, in the course of the recent days and weeks and months, comes more and more to the attention of an even broader public than those who are usually interested in financial news. Because I think behind the change in the banking industry at large, there is much more of not only economic, but social as well as political importance, namely a change in the whole environment compared to the one we used to live in the course of the last 50 years. So dealing with banking in the 21st century means dealing with discontinuities in our environment and dealing with change as such. And we live in a world of rapid change. The speed of change has increased dramatically in the course of the acceptance of information technology and especially the internet. Rapid change, on the other side, causes a lot of uncertainties with the ones being affected by change. And that is what we experience all over the place. A sense of being insecure, being afraid, being uncertain, being affected. And the cry for, the call for explanation, for analysis, for promises for the future. So what I try to do today is to present shortly the challenges and the reasons for those challenges, and based on that, a faint idea of how to deal with those challenges in the form of a strategy. One thing is clear.
Well, nothing is clear.
To just routinely apply strategies of the past and hope that they will continue to work in the future is absolutely the most riskiest option of all you've got. I want to deal in the following couple of minutes with the change drivers in banking, then the strategies how to deal with those change drivers, and deal especially with structures in order to succeed in the digital economy. So let me start with saying the challenges, the change drivers in banking, what are they? Well, very simply put, the markets have changed, the customers have changed, and the competitors have changed. Let me go into a little bit of detail. Markets have changed. Well, you see it. Markets have changed in the way that in former times the banks dealt with an information gap with regard to financial problems and their solutions. There was a gap between the customer and the bank advisor. The bank advisor had faster and more detailed information, whereas the customer came to receive information. That has changed dramatically since information technology has developed. Nowadays, the customer has instantly, every very second, the same full information about everything he is interested in as his bank advisor. So it was no longer the job of the bank advisor to bridge that gap. Today, it is the job of the bank advisor to channel information, to differentiate between those things which are essential for decision making and those which are, and that is the majority of information, which are not. So that has changed the job profile within banks dramatically. It is no longer somebody who just distributes information. It is the one who has the ability to differentiate, to tailor-make information, to distribute information to the customer only insofar as the customer needs it to make a diagnosis and to base a decision on information received. At the same time, the market is global. So you get the same information on every place in the world to the same extent, 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. The best example for a global product is the dollar. The dollar has the same price every second at places all around the globe. Minor differences in price are arbitraged away in the next second. So you really can get the same price, pound sterling against dollar, every second around the clock. That is a real global product in a real global market. and that has changed our business dramatically. Second, accordingly to that, the customer has changed his expectations, what he wants to get from the bank as a financial product, financial services altogether. It used to be the expectation that the bank was an institution which accepted in form of deposits or saving books or whatever your deposits, and on the other side were active in lending these money to those who needed finance. That is a traditional function. It is has moved away from this primary priority role downwards on the list of priorities. Nowadays, the customer expects from the bank more than that, namely to function as the portal to the capital markets. The interest of the investor has grown over and beyond just depositing his money. He now invests in capital market instruments, in more attractive, higher yielding ones, and so on and so forth. So he uses the bank as the intermediary to more sophisticated forms of depositing. On the other side, when going for finance, they no longer are satisfied with just receiving a plain vanilla consumer credit, so and so. They want to have more tailor-made, more customized, more sophisticated instruments, which then relate to capital markets. So if you have a look at the P&Ls of banks these days, you observe in the course of the years a decreasing emphasis on revenues out of interest rate related businesses, credit, loans on the one hand and deposit taking on the other, and an increasing emphasis on commissions received for services rendered. We are now in the second phase of this disintermediation, namely via the internet, some services banks used to offer since decades are absolutely obsolete. If you go on the internet and have a choice of mutual funds, you don't need the bank if you are educated and informed enough to make your choice. You just compare, you compare the content, the price, you make a click, and you have done the transaction. No bank involved, with the exception in the end, if you pay with your account or your credit card, then your bank account gets charged. But that's all. So what that all means is that disintermediation now is growing more and more, and for a lot of financial products, the bank is absolutely obsolete. Traditional functions just fade away. Nobody wants them anymore. On the other side, the internet creates new banking functions. I give you an example from the corporate world. Corporates these days go for their supplies to auction markets organized on internet. Steel, pulp and paper, forest products, natural resources. They have the choice. These are standardized products. The quality is defined. They compare, they click, and then, okay, then the second half starts, namely clearing and settlement. Somebody should take care of the latter part of the transaction, namely that the product being purchased arrives in time, in the quality required, and that only then payment takes place. So the usual thing, delivery only against payment of the product orders, that is a function banks traditionally do in financing foreign trade. Now it is transferred on the internet, and banks have a new function, namely the financial agent for the second half of a transaction corporates do on the internet. So what I want to show in these two simple examples is the internet changes customer demands and markets at the same time. Traditional markets just fade away. The customer doesn't need banks anymore in this regard, but new ones are created. So risk and chance for banks and internet are very close together. Thirdly, competition changes. If you ask me, what are you most afraid of with regard to competition? The answer is not so much bank XYZ. The answer is the non-banks and the near banks. Bill Gates once is quoted having said, banking is necessary, banks are not. So that's what I'm remembering every morning when I'm getting up. Quoting Bill Gates in this regard, of course, tells you something. He has his own agenda, most probably, in this regard. And that makes me sort of a little bit nervous. Meaning, those providers of sophisticated IT-based services can break up the value chain in banking. Traditional value chain goes from the manufacturer via execution to the distribution. So they do cherry picking. They do not do the whole value chain. They just cherry pick one piece of that where they are especially good, excellent, far above average of a normal bank. They excel in that. And since they are not required to have a very costly branch network, to be subject to a regulator, to have a lot of capital available, they are much cheaper. And given the quality of their services, at least the same, if not better, but a much lower cost basis, they have an advantage. You are defenseless vis-a-vis. And that exactly happens in the world of finance. Take a couple of examples, the first one being Charles Schwab. Charles Schwab, a firm just concentrating on the distribution of securities in the United States, and over the course of very few years, just putting the Merrill Lynches of this world against the wall, defenseless. Second example, General Electric Capital. They are a non-bank and near-bank as well. They concentrate on certain pieces in the French market of consumer finance. Big French banks, defenseless. The whole market is now in the hands of General Electric Capital. And a third example is Consors, a direct broker in Germany. It was founded 5 years ago, now is the fifth largest private bank in Germany. So these are examples which show this sort of deconstruction. Get a piece out of the value chain where you are better than the average bank. That is the main threat in internet banking and in banking altogether in the present environment. This, of course, is even enlarged by the advent of the euro. The euro has created a single money and capital market, second only to the United States. It is really large, it is liquid, it is transparent, and in this market, the competition is fiercer than ever. Margins go down, and volume increases, and the challenge is that you increase the volume you do and overcompensate by that the decrease in margins. Easier said than done, and not a zero-sum game, because not everybody can do the same. Not everybody can try to increase business volume and at the same time overcompensate the decreasing margins in the business overall. It is a business where the exit for the majority of players is to be foreseen. And that is something which troubles most of market participants these days, because they see the euro and the internet bring margins down. The volume, yes, it increases, but not as far that everybody can continue to survive. So that is real change in its most dramatic performance. Now, second, which strategies can be a basis for survival in the internet age in banking? I think that there are still three advantages where internet cannot replace in the foreseeable future banking in the way we understand it. The first one is advisory. I think that internet is a very good tool and medium to do financial services which are standardized or standardizable. There, this is a very good tool. It is convenient, it's comfortable, it's cheap. But if it comes to complicated financial topics where you have to have a bilateral sort of discussion, the internet is not the best medium to use. So back to the old sort of advisor, somebody who answers to your specific, to your individual complex financial needs and can answer questions which are not standardized and not standardizable. So advisory based on highly sophisticated research based on IT-based expert systems, that is something I feel banks still continue to excel. That is the one of the three pillars where banking is still needed. Second, risk management. Risk management is one of the most traditional functions of banking. you have certain currency or interest rate risk. You expect US dollars to come in 3 months' time, but you do not want to run the risk of a decrease in value. So we, the banks, take this risk away from you. You have to finance in a couple of months a certain purchase. You want to fix the interest rates on the present level because you expect an increase in rates. So we take the risk away from you and fix your rate in 3 months' time. That is a very natural, the natural function of banks. What do? We don't hold those risks for our own account. We rebundle them, we restructure them, we make new products out of them, and we place it with people who want to own those risks. So it is a transformation function. And that is something nobody takes away from banks. It is a business insurance companies hate. They do provide insurance protection against risk to a certain extent, but definitely other risks. So the financial risk, it is something where obviously banks have sort of a monopoly, and I don't see much competition in that. Third is transaction processing. As I said, volume of business increases. Convenience is the name of the game, and therefore internet produces more volume than before, just by being comfortable, giving approach to counterparties without any major efforts, and so on and so forth. Somebody has to take care of a correct, reliable, safe, secure processing of those transactions. There is only a few in the world, I guess, in the end, which really can provide those services, because they need a very big machine. And it is a play of economies of scale only. The more business you press through your machine, the lower your cost base is, and the more competitive you can offer your services. So that is a business only for a few really big boys. But anyway, it is something I do not see that outside the banking world there are many competitors for that. So these seem to me the main pillars of banking in the years to come, where we still have some sort of a very good basis to continue our business without too many looking for replacement of banks by other institutions. So based on these three pillars, what is the strategy? It is to provide a global connectivity between our customers and the markets they want to do business in. That is, by making our advisory competencies more available than before. That is, trying to shape, together with others, new electronic markets. That is, placing financial products via our global reach to more customers than before. And lastly, to provide a powerful technology and operations backbone to process a ever-growing volume of transactions. How do you go about that? I think partnering is the most favored way of doing so. In partnering, in contrast to the merger wave, in IT business, obviously partnering is the better means than merging, because the IT world is very fast changing. In a merger, you do something for eternity, say. Not so in internet business. In eternity in internet business is 3 years. After 3 years, maybe your partner is no longer the right one. Maybe you have different ideas and they go not parallel with the ideas of your partner. So you go and make an end to the partnership and look for a new one. So partnering in IT banking is obviously much more suitable to your strategy. Second, no exclusivity. When partnering, it is per definition in the internet world a non-exclusive partnership, because partners' needs and desires might change. If you have the partner and you need him for this and that, maybe the same is the right counterpart for one of your competitors as well, doing a little bit other things with him. So what you see in the internet world these days is a polygam world of partners just joining forces for very specific defined needs with a rather short horizon of the maturity of the deals. So with regard to geography and size of your business, which options would you have? I think basically three. One is to be a niche player. That sounds only small. It is a very valuable business proposition. The niche player is excellent in a specialty, either geographically or product-wise or whatever. He is much better than the average of his competitors, and he, by that, makes a wonderful living being the best reputed portfolio manager, say, in Italian securities. That is a fantastic business proposition because you are practically alone, you are good, and everybody who needs these specialties comes to you. Or you do a different sort of business with regard to a customer segment. Insofar, a niche player is a very valuable proposition for the future. A second option is grow your business organically, just build it. The disadvantages are obvious. It lasts very long, it is costly, and when you come to the end of your aspirations, the competition is already far away. So for me, the option just organic growth is the least efficient one. The third one is go into partnering, alliances, mergers. Yes, indeed, that is a valuable proposition because size these days has gained in importance. Usually in banking, size measured in balance sheet total doesn't tell you anything. It is worthless, more or less, because balance sheet total is just the addition of the assets and the liability side and doesn't tell you anything about the quality of the assets and the origin of the liabilities. We had a good example in the form of the Japanese banks, which for long, long years were the leaders in the world's running list of the biggest banks in the world. First one Japanese, second one Japanese, until fifth one Japanese. Nowadays, we know why. The quality of the assets is disastrous. So without criticizing that, it shows you in a nutshell that balance sheet total or the addition of assets without telling something about quality is not the right benchmark. Right benchmark is market capitalization, profitability, both are interrelated and correlated, of course, and other benchmarks, but not size. But size nowadays plays a role in efficiency because since the advent of the euro, which is one of the best examples for my thesis, since the advent of the euro, everybody in Euroland now and in the years to come does its business denominated in one single currency. That means there's no longer use from the side of a corporate customer to have a banking relationship in Germany, in France, in Spain, in Italy, and wherever, in every Euroland country where this corporate does some export-import related businesses. It is Euro all over. And so a fierce competition has started already more than a year ago, and beauty parades of commercial banks offering their services in Euro. And now it's a competition of a French bank against a German bank, against a Spanish bank, against an Italian bank, all offering their payment transfer services in Euro, for instance. That shows, in this context, size is of the essence, because you have to be present then in all those Euroland member countries as a financial institution. Otherwise, the customer will doubt your ability to offer payment services all across Euroland. And then financial soundness, stability, plays a certain role in the decision-making process of your customer. And that, again, is in some sort a question of size again. So we enter an era where size, apart from balance sheet total, gets a new meaning and a relevance in the priority set of the customer when deciding with which bank he wants to continue Euro banking. So alliances and mergers and partnerships help you out of this difficulty because it is not possible for each and everybody to just merge up to a European size. You have to find friends, partners, which in their home country are in a similar difficulty, and so the solution is joining forces, getting together, and providing your customer with Euroland facilities without being you, in your own capacity, being present in every other place. Let me now deal with structures to succeed in this environment. That is a topic which is very important, I think, and not so commonly discussed up to now. It deals with the continuing sort of evaluation of hierarchy vis-a-vis networks as forms of organization in big institutions. And my thesis is that the traditional hierarchy, defined as the distribution of power and authority in the form of a pyramid, small top, large bottom, has to be replaced at least partly by networking. Why is that? I think that in the world I tried to sketch here, it is no longer the right approach vis-a-vis problems just to analyze them, to sit back, to gather information, to put your foot on the brake, say, stand still, I have not gathered enough information, I'm not informed enough, I need more, and so just come to a sort of standstill until you feel encouraged to take a bold discussion. The internet world does not permit for that. The internet world requires an absolute different mindset in the decision-making process. The internet world is more directed towards let go, not just stand still, put the brakes on, just gather information. No, there's a problem, let the problem go, and try to get your allies together and leverage on their know-how. That is the organizational, the structural response vis-a-vis an upcoming problem. It is absolutely different because it is not that you can ask your superior and say, I have a problem, what shall I do? You have to ask your network counterparties, I have a problem, have you experienced the same? What did you do? Where is the know-how? Where can I get more help in dealing with the problem? So it is doing away with the pyramid, doing away with the traditional hierarchy. It is no longer reporting lines, it's horizontal communication. That changes the world, the structural, the organizational world of big institutions dramatically, because it is no longer that you have a chance just to control information for yourself and by that gaining in status, internal status. You are the one in charge of ample information. You keep it, you don't communicate it, you wait until somebody is forced to ask you because you are the only one who has the information. This sort of scheme is no longer the viable thing of organizing your institution. Distribution, instant distribution of available information into a network, open and available for everybody who wants the information, is the response to this sort of new problem environment. The first mover has, in the internet world, an absolute advantage. The world changes so fast that being the first mover, you get the market share you want, and only those who imitate you then have to look for the rest, leftovers, so to say. So first mover and adapt and build your organization and gain a critical mass of participants, that is how you have to go into those markets. What I mean by all that is that the new organization of an institution is sort of boundaryless. It is the way into a boundaryless organization. It is fluid structures rather than fixed structures. It is lack of reporting lines, but rather networking. It is reacting quickly to market changes and redirect resources. Your flexibility in reacting is that you reallocate human resources, capital resources, all resources you have on hand from a now no longer profitable or promising project into a more promising, more profitable project. Project is a buzzword in this context. What I'm talking about is a project-related, a project-directed organization. So a customer comes to the bank and has a certain infrastructure financing to do, a sort of utility power plant in China, and we form a project of different divisions, different know-how, different skills, get it together just for this particular case. And they work, maybe not only on this case, parallel on other cases as well, but in a different composition. So it is what we know from investment banking, from consultants, now transformed into banking at large. It is project rather than division and defined competencies. And those projects change all the time. They are very flat. They have not a huge hierarchy. They are just a network of know-how, people who contribute to the solution which finally then is offered to the customer. These organizations have a tendency to look outward rather than inward. Our traditional organizations love to keep busy, to keep themselves busy with inward analysis. Who does what, when, and why, and who should not do why and that. So the outward is, who knows more than we? Who is better in something than us? So the outward look is always lifelong learning. Re-establish the basis of know-how, be competitive, develop initiatives, question the common wisdom in your firm, try to cannibalize the present organization and replace it by something better. It is a huge challenge on people, on staff, and on superiors, because they have to feel questioned all the time. Hierarchy will be reduced to a very small layer of final decision making and the allocation of resources. It is no longer a status sort of function and the control of information. This, of course, changes the job profile. Somebody who wants to work in this sort of organization is different from those who traditionally filled the ranks of the existing commercial and investment banks. People who are interested in building networks, people who love to be empowered with competence, because the whole thing is hugely decentralized, the decision-making competence is far on the front and not in the head office. Head office is reduced to, as I said, some very basic decision-making processes and is very small. And the whole entrepreneurial commitment is out on the front, is with the customer, is empowerment outside, decentralized. So the job profile is that people should love this sort of being in charge, being accountable, even for failure and false decision making. Yes, of course, but that makes the fun of the job. That is a different kind of people who used to be happy receiving orders and achieving what was expected from them and then reporting back, mission achieved, what is next? It is an absolute different mindset which is required in this environment. And maybe that is an answer to the question of my presentation today, the challenges of banking in the 21st century. It's a different organization and different people as a response to changing markets, changing customers, and changing competition. It requires from top management, of course, a different mindset as well. It requires transparency of decision making, it requires a clear accountability with top management as well, and it requires a management which is prepared to incentivize this mindset with all staff from top to bottom. Let me close, ladies and gentlemen, with an Arabian proverb. An Arabian proverb which says, four things don't come back: the spoken word, the sped arrow, the past life, and the neglected opportunity. I wish you many opportunities in your life.
Well, Dr. Breuer has kindly set aside about a quarter of an hour for questions, so I think I'll leave you to select your questioners, remembering that there are people upstairs as well as downstairs, and there should be some roving mics around, so maybe questioners would wait for the mic to arrive so that everyone can hear them.
So, icebreaker.
Specifically, what would you, how would you describe the core competence of the old Deutsche Bank, and how would you imagine has that core competence been specifically enhanced through the merger?
One of the, or maybe even the core competence of Deutsche Bank is relationship. We are a relationship bank from our foundation onwards. We are not deal makers. We are not deal interested as a priority. So we cultivate the relationship, even if you have first to invest into the relationship before you get enough rewards out of that. Relationship is the main thing, and the merger gives us, whether we private clients as well as corporate clients, much more relationship and new ones for Deutsche Bank, or the other way around, new ones for Dresden Bank. So altogether, an addition in existing, already intact relationships from the partners. So we will we'll be one of the most powerful private banks in the world. If you measure that in assets under control from private clients, we are only 30 billion euro away from Credit Suisse and UBS, and that makes us number three in this business in the world. And with regard to corporates, the corporate market in Germany is characterized by a very strong mid-sized corporate market, the so-called Mittelstand, the middle market. And there, Dresden already, and Deutsche even more so, have been the market leaders, and together we are the one and only mid-market bank in Germany and beyond. So that is an increase in relationships, and by that, opportunities to exploit those relationships for the sake of our customers first and employees and shareholders as well.
In the history, there are some cases of big bankers who had a very sad end, or because
thank you very much.
Because they were not able to have the money back. For example, Florence in the 14th century lent money to the English king. The English king didn't pay back money, and the banking system of Florence went to bankrupt substantially. Aren't you afraid to be such an important bank in an institutional system, which the European institutional system, the German or European, which in the world is then not the main player, is at least the second player, or in the best option?
Well, I don't dare to go into the intricacies of lending to the King of England, but let me say, we lost a lot of money in lending in our 130 years old history. Yes, that is the name of the game. Every bank loses money, but the art of banking is to make prudent decisions that restrict the amount of losses you incur as sort of a more or less necessary by-result of your activities. And usually the fallout, if I may call that way, is in the regions of lower than 1% of the whole outstanding loans you have. So the name of the game is risk management. Where is it? And risk management is an art, and banks have to try to excel in risk management. It is a business with losses, per definition, but by prudent risk management, you can keep that in boundaries which make investing in a bank an attractive investment, for instance, for shareholders.
Now, Mr. Dwyer, you mentioned size and flexibility as one of the major questions in the future.
You mentioned size and flexibility as one of the major questions in the future banking market. I think one other important question is corporate image. And your bank has the problem of a rather unpleasant past as one of the major financial sources for Hitler's warfare in Europe, and even more the Dresdner Bank as the SS favorite bank. So I would like to know how much you pay in the reparation fund for the slave laborers, and if you put pressure on the companies you hold shares in to pay their share before all the slave laborers had have finally died.
Yes, indeed. We, Deutsche Bank, were, with others, Dresdner Bank as well, the founders of this initiative you were alluding to. And we made a very, very important point of that the present bank and the present managers and staff of the bank have not been personally involved. That is by historic accidents, because we were too young, maybe. So it is not a question of legal responsibilities or legal liability even. It is a question of moral responsibility, and we accept that case. We said, yes, we feel morally responsible for what has been committed in the years you alluded to, especially during the Second World War, by our predecessors, both personally and as an institution. And so we declared fit and ready to contribute to this initiative in order to, at least partially and only financially, because that is the way which was then open, to making good for damages vis-a-vis those people who still survived the dreadful events of the Second World War, especially with regard to slave labor. So Deutsche Bank never employed slave labor. What we did in this context was absolutely different. It was, we participated in dealing in gold, and the origin of that gold was quite of unclear at that point in time. And we acted as intermediaries in the disappropriation of property and businesses. So that is something we feel responsible for, and we feel that should be part of the initiative which is underway. I personally participated in the first negotiations from the German government. I went together with the official delegate to Washington to deal with Secretary Eisenstadt. So I felt personally very much involved in that, and I'm more than happy that the whole discussions came close to an end. I mean, basically, the parties have agreed to a sum and have agreed to those who should participate in the money of the initiatives. I really hope that we are very close to the final end of the negotiations. We will participate substantially in bringing up the money which is necessary. And yes, indeed, I personally get onto my customers and tell them that is an act of solidarity of German business. It is not the question, do you have interest in America and therefore be threatened in your businesses in the United States more than others who don't have interest in America? It is not a question of have you employed slave labor or not. It is a question of solidarity of German business vis-a-vis dreadful events in the past of most of German businesses. I'm optimistic that we reach the final goal, that we get up with a very sizable amount altogether, and that this amount then goes into the channels where we at least have a chance to those survivors which survived the dreadful events of the Holocaust and are still living, and they are high in their 80s these days, that they still get something to make the rest of their life a little bit more comfortable than before.
Dr. Breuer, I'd like to focus a little bit on the two issues that you spoke about, partnership and the effect of the euro. You spoke particularly about the need to be able to be a player in different markets right across Europe. Does that mean that in terms of alliances and in terms of partnerships, Deutsche Bank will be focusing a little bit more and maybe merging or making alliances with other banks across Europe? Is that the overall strategy?
The question, or the answer is yes, of course. We are already the biggest non-Italian bank in Italy. We are the biggest non-Spanish bank in Spain. We are sizable in the Benelux countries. and all around our home country, yes, indeed, with one exception, is France. France was not very much an open market in the normal sense of the word, and we had some difficulties. But yes, indeed, that is not the end yet. We want to expand. We want to establish our position even more strongly. And we look for partners. We look for sort of alliances, even sort of acquisitions if necessary.
Does that just a follow-on point, does that mean that the U.S. should watch out?
Well, I think after the acquisition of Bankers Trust last year, we are the largest non-American bank in the United States. And up to now, nobody of our friendly competitors from outside the United States had a chance to establish themselves in a similar position, because that is the most competitive financial market in the world, and the Americans are very, very efficient. So it is an uphill struggle if you don't acquire an existing functioning banking institution. That is what we did. We integrated very successfully. We are very proud that we did it faster and more successful than we expected. It even went beyond our own hopes and expectations. And in so far, Bankers Trust gave us a transatlantic position second to none with regards to the question you said, is that the lack of interest in the United States? The answer is no. And maybe Bankers Trust is even not the end.
Given what you said about the impact of the euro on the pattern of European banking, what do you think would be the impact on the City of London if we stay outside?
I think that the City of London is competitive enough to survive even that. I would wish that the City of London would join rather sooner than later the single European euro-denominated financial market, because being not member, of course you trade in euro-denominated vehicles and products and services and so on and so forth, but you are excluded from the decision-making processes. And that, in the end, if it really drags on over a couple of years, is a disadvantage, no doubt about that. And we want you in. I think the city has so much experience and talent that it is to the good of the whole community that you have a chance to contribute an input into the decision-making processes. So it is, from the point of view of the continental European financial markets, more than wishable that you join the euro rather sooner than later. Selfish reasons, I admit that.
Do you believe that Frankfurt will ever replace London as the European's main financial center?
You are partnering in the same question, are you? The answer is no, I don't think so. The basis of the strength of the London financial market is the institutional business, and that is second to none. And I don't see any sign that that will decrease. So I dare to say that Frankfurt, yes, the city of the euro, it has a chance to get the biggest financial center on the continent. But I would not think that they have a chance to replace London as a financial center. And I even would like to say that is not the ambition and the aspiration of Frankfurt. I don't think that there is not enough room for two financial centers of very different bases and backgrounds and history and structure and roots, and by that, advantages for the customer.
You rightly say that the shift in mindset required to be a successful banker in the 21st century must be driven by top management. How are you communicating this to your staff? How are you incentivizing it? And is this blurred by the merger process?
We are not satisfied with the transformation process you mentioned. It is that, yes, the right information cascades down from the top. Yes, the right answers come back from the bottom. We have always the middle level, a layer. We in Germany call it the clay layer. It is clay and it sucks the water from top and from bottom, and there it stays to no avail. It is unfortunate, it is a problem, and we have to educate the middle layer. The middle layer is hindering this process you are alluding to, and we do everything to incentivize the middle layer to communicate, to open up, to be part of the whole effort. This is the most difficult task in the whole process. It is not at the top, it is not at the bottom. Both are very much willing to contribute. It is always the middle layer being afraid of a loss in stature, in function, in competence, in reputation, or what have you. They are afraid to lose, and that is why they are hindering it and sticking to the old model. We are working on that up to now, not to my satisfaction, I admit that. Lady on the top.
I think you have to speak up more loudly. Oh, the mic is very rapidly from the right.
Dr. Breuer, would you say that the concept of a universal bank is dead, but Deutsche Bank, within the five new divisions, would concentrate on becoming the market leader in each of those fields?
I think that the traditional universal banking model, if you mean by that being everything for everybody everywhere financially, it's dead. Yes, nobody can spread its capabilities and skills as far away.
But does Deutsche Bank see the five board divisions that will be created as a result of the merger as those fields which banks should be active in if they want to be global players?
What has that to do with our five layers? Maybe I didn't get it acoustically.
Sorry. Say, like, in moving away from retail banking and towards stuff like international property lending, I know what I'm trying to say, and I rehearsed it.
No, well, I think I got you now. It is. it is not the exit out of the business with the private customer. It is what we, for reasons of non-efficiency, non-profitability, want to get out over time, the standardized branch-based retail, mass retail banking. So it is the payment transfers, the checking accounts, the credit card business, which is low margin, standardized, and via a branch network, very, very costly in Germany. I know that Lloyds TSB and others in your country, I know that the Spanish bank show that mass retail banking can be very profitable indeed. We do know that, but we cannot do it in Germany because market shares do not permit. The market shares of the British retail banks, the successful ones, are much higher than, for instance, Deutsche Bank. Ours is 6. Dresdner Bank is 4. Together we get 10. That is a laugh. It is nothing. We cannot make prices. We are not leading in any way. We are just suffering from the competition, which is the savings and loans. And the savings and loans in Germany have a 50% market share. So fighting against that is useless. We came to an end of all our endeavors to get more efficient, more profitable. I get letters every day from customers complaining, queuing in the branches, nobody takes care of them, and so on and so forth. So we really, in rationalizing, got to the very limits of customer satisfaction. And that is the end. So the conclusion was, stand alone, not possible. Get together with somebody else who has the same problems and try economies of scale. That's the reasoning.
I'm really sorry, I've only got time for one more question because of Dr. Breuer's tight schedule, so I think you should certainly choose the last questioner.
Show of hands. He's nearest to the micro, that's the reason.
Dr. Breuer, you were speaking about uncertainty and fears in the beginning of your speech. How would you comment on on press releases, recent press releases, saying that your merger with Dresdner Bank is mainly forged out of fear, not out of creating value? I quote, I think it was the Spiegel, where ABN AMRO calculated that you were actually losing 6 billion, I think it was euro or D-marks, in the merger instead of creating money?
I'm afraid I could not follow that analysis. I really didn't understand it, quite frankly. Maybe that's my fault. But I tell you what it's really all about. I think that the major driver behind this merger is the element I just discussed when discussing retail. It is domestic consolidation. And that is very necessary for an international bank, because you can only be successful internationally if you are very strong in your home country. I don't know of any example in international finance where an international institution is really successful without having based this international strength on a defined strength in its home market. So that is the background. The background could be only solved by getting together with somebody who had the same problems and solve it together. It does not necessarily contribute to other parts of the business. Of course, the merger we went into with Dresdner's added strengths to strengths. Just think about the industrial holdings, where we, as Professor Giddins said, over time want to get rid of, that is, divestments. We get together 33 billion euro in holdings which have nothing to do with banking. Ammunition, maybe, to take a shot to this or that. We are the biggest number three private bank internationally. We are one of the biggest corporate banks for the mid-market customers throughout Europe. We are, in investment banking, after the acquisition of Bankers Trust, making in global markets, in global equities, in equity markets, in structured finance, in project finance, always one of the first five rankings in the world. One exception, mergers and acquisitions, where we have grown dramatically, but where we are still have some way to go until we really compete head on with the three big American houses, Goldman's, Morgan Stanley's, and Merrill Lynch. But altogether, it adds strength to strength internationally as well as domestically, and I think it is for the good of the shareholders.
For the select few, there is a dinner on the fifth floor of the old building. For those who don't know the LSE, you go out of this door, you turn towards the lifts, you take lift to the fifth floor, and you turn right when you get out of the lift. In the meantime, could I say how good it is to have Dr. Breer here, and say how much personally I enjoyed the lecture, and I'm sure everyone in the audience do, judging by the show of hands they did. Thank you.
Good reception, yeah? Is it? I don't know. That's a moment of reception.